You're about to meet two families, united by tragedy. They were thrust into the international news spotlight on the worst days of their lives. And now, years later, something good is coming from it all. These families are helping keep reporters safe in war zones. It is the ultimate tribute to their sons. This is the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm your host, Brian Stelter. And this weekly podcast, in between our Sunday television program, is a chance to go more in-depth with media leaders and newsmakers. And this week, I'm joined by two parents who never wanted to be in the news. But their kids were inspired to become journalists. And that's why they're here with me today. I think you probably remember both of the names of their kids. First, James Foley. He was a freelance war correspondent, writing for Global Post, recording video for AFP, appearing on the PBS NewsHour. He was tireless. He was committed to covering the suffering of the Syrian people. Foley was abducted in northwest Syria in November 2012. And over time, it became clear that he was being held by ISIS. At the time, this group ISIS was barely known by Americans. It was kind of a mystery. Foley's family fought for his release, worked through diplomatic channels, Global Post did as well. And in July 2014, the U.S. attempted a top-secret rescue mission to free Foley and other hostages. But the mission failed. U.S. bombings in Iraq against ISIS, ordered by President Obama, were increasing the pressure on the terrorist group. And so the group sent a message. On August 19th, 2014, ISIS released a video showing Foley speaking, then showing him being murdered, his head cut off by a man in black.
Today, the American people will all say a prayer for those who love Jim. All of us feel the ache of his absence. All of us mourn his loss. We keep in our prayers those other Americans who are separated from their families.
The other Americans. Yes, there were others. Like Stephen Sotloff, the other journalist in this story. He was kidnapped at the Syria-Turkey border in August 2013. Sotloff was a contributor to Foreign Policy magazine and to Time magazine. Like Foley, he was doing really important work covering the conflict. The video of Foley's death showed Sotloff, and ISIS said he would be killed next if the airstrikes did not stop. Well, the airstrikes did not stop. And on September 2nd, ISIS released another beheading video, this time of Sotloff. Foley's parents, Sotloff's parents, and the other loved ones of other American hostages were connected, in part through the work of David Bradley, the chairman of The Atlantic magazine. The parents were united through this horror. And now, 5 years since that brutal summer, the Foley family and the Sotloff family are helping others. Each family has a foundation. They are independent of each other, but definitely complementary, doing similar, really important work. The James Foley Legacy Foundation, founded by his mother Diane, advocates for hostages and provides journalist safety guides. And the Stephen Sotloff Memorial Two Lives Foundation, founded by his parents Art and Shirley, finances safety training sessions and presents scholarships to students. Diane Foley and Art Sotloff join me now. Thank you so much both for being here. Diane, first, just a basic question. How are you doing? What is your life like these days?
Well, we're challenged. Both Arthur and I, we want to continue the legacy of our brave sons. You know, in our case, Jim Foley and Stephen Sotloff. They both were intrepid courageous journalists who really wanted the world to know of the suffering of the Syrian people. So my challenge has been to continue Jim's spirit. So the James Foley Legacy Foundation advocates for freedom of all Americans who are taken hostage abroad and for the protection of journalists worldwide.
And Art, same question for you. How are you doing 5 years later?
We're doing okay. I have a purpose now. We have a purpose of Stephen's legacy and protecting journalists, giving him training, first aid training and survival training, which is called HEFAT. And it's very rewarding to us to see that we're making a difference in these young, I have to say, young freelance journalists. I'm very proud that we have the opportunity to be able to offer these type of courses. The first course that we did, which was last year, they were between 25 and 30 years old. And I went, wow, look at their kids, just like my son. And independently, they came up to me and they said, if it wasn't for you and your wife and the foundation, that they never would have been able to afford this type of training. And when I started to get this feedback, I realized this was really something that I had to do throughout the years. And more than once a year, we're looking to do 3 to 4 training sessions a year.
Mm. How often do the two of you talk? I know that you all are in communication, Art and Diane. How often do the families communicate?
Well, we live in different parts of the country, but we do certainly keep in touch regarding our work and, accountability for the crimes against our sons and the Syrian people.
Do you remember, Art, when you all first met? I wonder what that could have been like.
Well, we didn't really speak to each other for the first 3 months. I think it was December when we realized that Stephen was with other people, and we started to find out who the families were, and Diane was one of the families, and we also had the K6, and we also had Kayla Mueller's family, and we all came together through phone calls, introducing ourselves, and obviously, since we were all suffering the same pain, we became one, and we've had many trips to Washington, D.C., going to the White House. So we have spent a lot of time together.
And that August of 2014, when James was executed, what did that mean for your family, Art?
Well, that was actually the first time that we were able to see Stephen. And to see Stephen in that situation where he was being held up by his neck, and a message to our President Obama that Stephen's life depends on his next move. And a couple hours later, I believe he did a very big bombing in Iraq, and that kind of sealed my son's fate.
I'd like to mention also that we really did not know that our sons were together at all. And it was through the goodness of a private citizen, David Bradley, in Washington, D.C., who actually found out and invited us to meet one another. That's how we really connected, because FBI was essentially keeping us apart to protect us, they thought. But it was a solace to know that Jim was not alone in his last hours for me.
And this work by Bradley, the chairman of The Atlantic, this was happening in 2013 and 2014, bringing these families together. He really played a pivotal role.
He did.
In August of 2014,
absolutely,
when Jim was killed, what were those communications like, Diane? I hate to make you think back to 5 years ago, but I wonder what it was like for these families, because all of a sudden, your very personal battle trying to get your son home, all of a sudden it was this international story. All of a sudden these newsrooms were trying to figure out what to do with this sickening video. But for you, it was, of course, it wasn't a news story, it was real life.
Well, exactly, Brian. And our government really did not know how to react, to be honest. We found out that Jim was truly killed when we watched on TV President Obama confirming his murder. So we really did not receive any prior awareness. Hysterical journalist called me earlier that day to let me know about the video. Otherwise, I would not have known. Our government did not reach out at all in those 24 hours. So it was a very isolating, horrific time. And that is partly why the Foley Foundation is so passionate about engaging with our government and making sure our government takes care of families and truly has our back and is willing to advocate for the return of courageous Americans who go out in the world to work. So I do not want other families to go through what we all went through and the way we were treated.
It must have been shocking for your family and also for the other families like Art's family to find out that there wasn't a structure. There wasn't even someone to call you.
Right. Exactly. And I don't fault anyone. They truly did not know what to do or how to handle it. I really think the jihadists took our government totally by surprise. I don't think they had any idea the level of hatred and brutality that this group was capable of.
So, Art, in these videos, you see Stephen, you start to realize that these Americans are being held together in some cases, that they were with each other at the end. But
yes,
what were those weeks like for you now knowing that ISIS was willing to go to these extremes?
Well, as soon as we found out about Jim's death and what was going to happen to Stephen, Mr. Bradley and his team brought us immediately to Washington, D.C., trying to brainstorm what was the next move. And the next move, we felt, was for my wife, Shirley, to do a video to Baghdadi, I guess, pleading for Stephen's life. And that's what she did. And that was received by empty ears, because there was no response to that whatsoever. And then about a week and a half later, we saw Stephen being executed also for the whole world to see. And I've spoken to many people. I won't say that it's funny, but there's two things that people remember of the past. One of them is September 11th, when the buildings came down, and unfortunately, when Jim and Stephen were executed in front of the world. And those are the two most vivid scenes that a lot of people remember in history.
And Stephen was only 31 years old.
That is
correct. In 2014. Do you, 5 years later, have any thoughts about how the news media treated the videos, whether to show, what to show? Have you reflected on that with the passage of time, Art?
I realize, unfortunately, that there's people that enjoy watching stuff like that. And I think that's probably the reason why they tried to limit the exposure of that type of film. I don't know. I try not to think about it. I think about positive things and what our plans are and us doing good things, making a difference in the world. And I try to stay away from the negative thoughts.
Yeah. Diane, Jim was 40 years old in 2014. Do you think about where he would be today? Do you think about what he would be accomplishing in journalism?
Well, sure. And that is why I applaud all of you courageous journalists who dare to continue to report the truth, to investigate the truth, to report from dangerous parts of the world and even domestically on subjects that people may not want to hear the truth on. And that is why Art and I and other families through our foundations want to create this culture of safety so that journalists who want to become report on the truth in the world, know how to protect themselves, the subjects that they interview, and dare to speak the truth to power in the world. So that is why the Foley Foundation also has developed a curriculum, a safety curriculum for graduate students, and most recently we're working on undergraduate students so that they realize that in addition to the being able to tell stories and report the truth, that they know how to protect themselves, their sources, and so that they can continue to do this important work.
Do you view the efforts between the two foundations as complementary? Is that the best way to think about them?
Absolutely. And we're both part of an international alliance for a culture of safety that was established in 2015, which brought together media groups, press freedom groups, and freelancers, because both Jim and Stephen were freelancers who did not have the protection that many staff journalists would have in a conflict zone. So we're very passionate about the protection of these brave journalists in the world.
Let's talk more about what the two foundations are doing, both in the journalist safety front and on the hostage advocacy front. Much more on the Reliable Sources podcast in just a moment. And we're back right now on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm here with Diane Foley and Art Sotloff. Art, what motivated your son, Stephen, to go to these conflict zones to try to figure out what was going on? He did reporting for a number of news outlets, including CNN. And as Diane just mentioned before our break, he was a freelancer, just like Diane's son, Jim. So both were in the field without all the protections that you might have from a big news organization when you're on staff. What motivated Stephen to go and do that work as a freelancer?
Stephen went on a trip to Israel. And while he was there, he just fell in love with Israel and the Middle East. And he wanted to go to school there when he came back. And he ended up registering into a school there, and he graduated cum laude, and he did very, very well. But he was very, very unhappy with what he was seeing going on around him. When he was seeing the brutality of what was going on in Lebanon and in Syria, he felt that he had to do something. He had to report what was going on. He went on a couple trips on his own just to see what was going on with the refugee camps. And he just decided that's what he needed to do. He wanted to be the voice of the voiceless.
And Diane, is the story similar for your son?
Well, Jim had three younger siblings who were in the military. So after Jim chose to become a journalist, he spent quite a bit of time in Iraq and Afghanistan, embedded with the military, so to better understand why men went into the military. But also he became very touched by the impact, the horrible impact of war on innocents, on civilians. And therefore, when the Arab Spring started, he felt it was an essential story that the West needed to hear, that we Americans and other Westerners needed to know the depth of the suffering of those people. And I think the more he saw, the more compelled he felt to return because it was becoming more and more dangerous. Many staff journalists were pulling out. So it was left to freelancers like Stephen and Jim to continue to bring the news and photographs, the truth to our countries.
Mm. And now, as we've been talking about, both of you run foundations working to help protect journalists in harm's way. Art, yours is named the Stephen Sotloff Memorial Two Lives Foundation. You and your wife, Shirley, run the foundation. I wondered about the name. I think the name Two Lives comes from a letter that Stephen wrote you, right?
Yes. There was a letter smuggled out that an Italian prisoner, when he was released, because his country, by the way, paid for him to get out, he was able to smuggle a letter to us. And it was a letter that it was really his last will and testament. He was telling us that we should find closure, that not to let the government sweep the scandal under the rug, that we should start a memorial for him. He was actually telling us that we should be doing, it was like a blueprint of how I should, or how we should run our life. Hmm. And he said, don't fight, love each other every day, have dinner with each other every day, and again, to find closure. And then he said, everyone has two lives. The second one begins when you realize you only have one. And when I read that, that just, you know, said it all. And when Stephen passed, that stuck in our mind. And when I decided that we were going to start a foundation, that's the name that I picked, Two Lives Foundation.
And both of these keep their legacies very much alive. Diane, your foundation called the James W. Foley Legacy Foundation. People can find it at jamesfoleyfoundation.org. And y'all do a couple different things. Along with the journalism safety curriculum, there's also events like a golf tournament, runs. Tell me about the motivation, the purpose behind these events.
Well, for us, it's primarily for fundraising. I mean, I think it's difficult for Americans to realize or even recognize the challenges that journalism is going through at the moment and the silent crises of innocent Americans taken hostage or unjustly detained around the world. I had no idea that there are hundreds of Americans every year and thus their families who go through this ordeal. So our Freedom Run every October is Jim's birth month, if you will. So we do an international and virtual Freedom Run to raise awareness for the essential aspect of journalism in our democracy, and also to raise awareness about Americans who are held hostage around the world.
And you just released a report about this titled Bringing Americans Home, the first non-governmental assessment of U.S. hostage policy and family engagement. People can find this on your website as well. What are the key findings from this report?
What we wanted to do was a year after Jim and Stephen, Kayla and Peter were murdered, there was an outcry in our government, and President Obama did a hostage review, which resulted in a restructuring of how our government handles hostage cases, created a fusion cell, an envoy, and a response group at the White House. So we wanted to see as a foundation, is this making a difference for Americans? Mm. So last year, we undertook a qualitative review. We interviewed 27 individuals, either families or returned hostages, to see if it had changed anything. And we found that, yes, these days, American families are better cared for who are going through this ordeal. Our government has a family engagement person, and we are coordinated in that it's an interagency effort. So the FBI is, in fact, working with intelligence, State Department and such, which was not the case when we went through this in 2013, 2014 for us. So there has been some improvement for sure, Brian. Yes.
And let's remember there are ongoing cases, ongoing kidnappings. Austin Tice's name comes to mind right away when we're talking about Syria and talking about disappearances. What is the latest on the Tice case?
The Tice case continues. I mean, it really, it's horrific. 6 years now, Austin was taken before Jim. And they're really, our government is working, however, hand in hand with the Tice family. And that is the difference. I do, they feel that support. However, he is not home. And nor is there's a psychologist, a Syrian American by the name of Maj Kamalmaz, who was helping in Lebanon refugee camps, helping children with post-traumatic stress. And he went in to visit a family member and was accosted and has been held since. So this is something that occurs around the world, particularly in countries such as Syria, Turkey, Venezuela, North Korea, but also other parts of the world, Mexico. I mean, we can go on and on. It is a growing crisis, and our government is trying to step up, and our job as the Foley Foundation is continue to work with our government to increase awareness in our public sphere.
And kidnapping is one of numerous dangers that journalists face in these conflict zones. Art, just getting the idea of your safety course, this is something that started last year, and people can check it out at 2livesfoundation.org, the number 2livesfoundation.org. How can people help make sure that more journalists are able to be trained to be able to have this kind of conflict zone training?
Well, these journalists can't afford to have this type of training. And I think if we had a little bit more participation to the companies and agencies that they supply their stories to, if, you know, they're making millions and millions of dollars off of their commercials and so forth, if they would take a small amount of that income and help support the Foley Foundation and the Two Lies Foundation to give them this type of training, which eventually they're going to benefit by, because they're getting stories that they're supplying, hopefully, to these agencies.
Right.
They get paid nothing. They're out there by themselves. They're paying for fixers. They're paying for their hotels if they can find one. And there's no support. And they have no insurance. And I really feel that some of the big agencies, the CNNs and Associated Press and Fox News and all of them, that they should be supporting us so we can support giving training to these freelance journalists. The journalists that I met that have taken our training have said to us that, if it wasn't for our organization and also what the Foley's organization does, that they wouldn't be able to afford to even come. And it's very, very essential. This is training that saves lives. It makes them think correctly. It teaches them first aid, security on their computers, how to handle yourself in interrogations, breathing properly, just things that everybody needs to know. And I think there has to be a wide cooperation between the whole industry.
I certainly agree. What we need is an understanding in that a lot of the work is being covered by freelancers, in fact. And that is one of the major goals of our Alliance for a Culture of Safety, and is that we need to increase access to these very costly but outstanding courses for these brave journalists who continue to report from very dangerous parts of the world.
The news is going to keep coming. We've got to keep covering it. We've got to keep covering it as safely as possible.
Exactly, Brian. And that's why I think it's essential that the public understands, that media companies step up, which many of them have through this Culture of Safety Alliance. And so we're so grateful for that. We need that financial support for these freelancers so that they can be well trained in terms of safety all around.
Diane and Art, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you for your time, Brian.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And that's a wrap on this week's Reliable Sources podcast. We will see you on television this Sunday and every Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on CNN. Thank you for tuning in.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.